You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. Today's show is brought to you by Ducks Unlimited, the leading conservation group for restoring habitat for waterfowl and all things wild to benefit the nation's hunters. Howdy, folks. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Dreeslein. Happy to be with you. We're going to spend the next hour talking outdoor topics here in our fine state of Minnesota. A little later, we'll have Stan Tequila with us for the second week in a row. I think we'll talk about some of his winter trips. I know he was out in Yellowstone and Florida, so maybe we'll chat with him about that. We'll also have John Schneider, a longtime friend of Outdoor News from Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Ducks Unlimited, who just recently was honored with an award from National DU. Tori McCormick had a nice profile of John a couple weeks ago, and he joins us this week to talk about that a bit. Les Meister will help me wrap things up, but we're going to kick it off with Tim Spielman, editor at Minnesota Outdoor News. Tim, welcome, and Glenn Schmidt in the Fisher Report is telling us that there's open water fishing getting going pretty good in the southern half of the state.
Yeah, boats in the water, people fishing from shore. The Mississippi sounds super busy. Sounds also like at the far other end of the state that the rain is opening up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So people are starting to fish that early season.
I saw a sturgeon pick, a sturgeon photo from the rainy.
Yeah, and it's funny because on Facebook today, a couple of my neighbors had posted, it must have just snowed a year ago. And I saw these images and wow, it's just, I should get over it, but it really is hard to fathom the difference between last year and this year. And the fact that last year, there was just all kinds of snow on the ground yet and ice on lakes, and it lasted a while.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was still another couple of weeks before it began to melt, so to any meaningful extent. So, yeah, it's still pretty crazy.
I got to think the Mississippi River, that's got to be just awesome. That's got to be fish in a barrel down below some of those dams with the water as low as it is and those fish concentrated. I got to get down there. It's been a few years since I fished that. That is a lot of fun. When those fish are just stacked below the dams.
That was the impression I got from Glenn Schmidt's fishing report today, was that action was fast and furious.
Oh, I got to think so. Tim, a lot of headlines. We should talk about the big ones here. The dam has burst, I would dare say, on these efforts to move state land to the tribes. The Outdoor News had the story about the White Earth situation several weeks ago. I think the Strib had it last week, and I saw a ton of social media chatter about it, and I was like, hey, we had it weeks earlier. This week, you've got a big story. We had legislation drop on Monday the 11th that would move a chunk of property and presumably all of Upper Red Lake, the state portion of that, to the Red Lake Band. This is a really big story. You columnized on it as well as wrote an extensive front cover news story about it.
Yeah, the Red Lake information came along just as I was putting the finishing touches on my White Earth State Forest land transfer stories. The White Earth story also was a big one, but it played second fiddle, as it turned out, to the Red Lake one. I think I was able to find a lot of good information regarding White Earth State Forest, which was to be under the terms of a bill transferred to White Earth Nation, about 155,000. Anyway, big chunk of land. And the thing about that was a lot was learned because there was actually a Senate hearing where the bill author testified, Mike Fairbanks, the chair of White Earth Nation, testified, and then a whole host of people from Clearwater, Becker, and Menominee counties, they also testified. So there was a lot of information to glean from for a story. When Red Lake occurred, folks from the DNR even said, you know, as I have a quote from Bob Meyer, an assistant commissioner who spends the vast majority of his time over at the Capitol addressing bills this time of year. Mm-hmm. He's done that for a number of years, and so he's up on things, put it that way. But he said with the Red Lake one, there are just more questions than answers right now. Trying to figure that all out was a little bit tough. You had to go from the bill, and the bill basically says that all the land around Upper Red Lake, including a one-mile buffer, state-administered lands, would be transferred to Red Lake Nation, as well as all of Red Lake State Forest. Acreage on that I would have to check out. But it's a big chunk of land, and similar to White Earth, it's a lot of mixed ownership within that. I mean, a state forest, you might presume that it's just a state forest. But within that state forest, you look at, I'll just use White Earth, for example, you've got federal land ownership, which is pretty minute in that state forest. The largest landowner, I believe, is the state of Minnesota. You've got private land. A big chunk of it is already tribal land. So it's a patchwork, and those things are very difficult to work through. So there's nothing at all simple about these.
And then, Tim, there's $20 million in there too, right? What exactly is that for? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know if it's to...
$20 million here and $20 million there. You know, it adds up, right?
Yeah, it's to make this transfer happen.
I see.
And it does mention that the DNR can use it to acquire land. So I'm not sure what it means. You know, when we first hear about a land transfer around Upper Red, you'd think, what about the lake itself? And most of the people I've talked to, the smart people I've talked to, have said that if Red Lake Nation wanted to get the entirety of Upper Red Lake back, which they do.
Yeah, they've been very clear about that, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a matter for the feds, the federal Department of the Interior.
That's the first thing I thought, too, right, yeah.
Yeah, but on the flip side, if you run out of access to the lake, by default, it's almost off limits to state anglers. Now, there's a lot of private land around there. I still was in, my brain was in ice fishing mode, so I thought, well, most of the people that go out on Upper Red to ice fish go through resorts, and they do. But come summertime and open water fishing, which isn't quite the big deal that ice fishing is, but it's still a big deal. A lot of that traffic goes through, there's a access that I've not parked at, but I've gone past many times. It accommodates lots and lots of boats and trailers and trucks and such. And, you know, if the land was, state land was transferred to the band up there, there goes that access, right?
Wow.
So there's a lot to be answered. You know, it's so hard to figure out how this is going to go because the Upper Sioux Land State Park transfer last year, the DNR was on board with that from the outset. That basically went through, I mean, there was a lot of uproar about it, but as far as legislatively speaking, it didn't run into many hurdles.
No.
White Earth, on the other hand, seemed to. The fact that it was tabled by the DFLers after that hearing might indicate that, well, we're not sure what we're going to do with this. And a Republican Senator, Steve Green, who represents that area around White Earth.
And is a White Earth enrollee.
He's an enrolled member as well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Who's opposed to that mentioned on Monday that there was a DFL senator from Moorhead who decided he would not support that legislation. Mm-hmm. And it's a narrow margin for the Democrats in the Senate.
Sure.
And so that, I called it a possible death knell. That might have been a little dramatic, but signs were that the White Earth transfer wasn't going to just breeze on through. If Red Lake is like that, I don't know if it will be or not. Mm-hmm. It hasn't had a hearing yet. As we speak, there hasn't been a hearing. You got to have a hearing before a bill can advance.
Yeah, I wonder if a little bit of this is floating this legislation out, see what kind of backlash there is to it. And by the way, if you're listening and you'd like to provide a little backlash to it, check out Spielman's column. He provided phone numbers for a lot of the authors of this legislation. Call them up and tell them you don't like it, the Red Lake specifically. So, you know, are they kind of floating this out there, see what the response is? If it's not that bad, well, maybe they don't get it done this year, see how the election goes, and slam it through next year. That's just a quick hypothesis.
Yeah, that crossed my mind too, but boy, oh boy, everybody is up for re-election in the House this fall, right?
Yep, not the senators, but all the House, yeah.
Right, yep. And so now, for things like this, seems like the perfect time. do you wait and see if the house swings in the fall? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. It just seems like now would be the time.
Hey, we're about out of time, but one other thought. Your story mentioned on the White Earth thing that I believe Bob Meyer said they really weren't aware of what White Earth was up to. And when I was at the round table, I specifically asked after the Upter Sioux thing, in front, they're in the final Q&A, are there any other deals on the table to transfer state lands to the bands? And Sarah Strowman stood up in front of everybody and said, not that we're aware of. Your story says that the White Earth, I don't remember who it was it the one of the tribal leaders, said, we've been emailing the DNR about this.
According to Bob Meyer, a few months ago, they'd been talking, I don't know how seriously, with the White Earth Nation about co-management as a possibility. But I believe when he says that as far as the bill goes and knowing it was coming, I don't think they knew that the bill was coming.
Okay, good. I guess.
Well, the same thing can be said for Red Lake. I've read enough to know that this is what Red Lake had pushed for. The governor was, or his representatives were at a tribal session last fall, and among the many notes that were taken down was included from Red Lake Nation, we want this land back. And, you know, I'm sure the water would come later, but that it's been stated many times. It's not a secret. To me, when I wrote the story about White Earth, prior to the Red Lake announcement, I thought, gosh, you know, after reading all this, I bet the Red Lake legislation is going to come fairly soon. And sure as heck, it came that very day. So if I have that inkling, a lot of people have better inside information than I do.
Okay, well, this will be a big one to watch unfold as the session continues and looking ahead, too. But I encourage folks, check out Tim's story. Swing by the Northwest Sports Show. Pick up your free copy of Outdoor News. You can read Tim's story and his column on the topic. So, Tim, thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, sounds good.
Yep, Tim Spielman, editor at Minnesota Outdoor News. Let's break more of the program after these messages.
Don't miss the Discover Boating Northwest Sports Show in partnership with Progressive Insurance, March 14th through 17th at the Minneapolis Convention Center. It's your last chance to gear up before the boating and fishing season openers. Find once-a-year show deals on hundreds of new boats, plus fishing tackle, docks and lifts, marine electronics, ATVs, hunting and outdoor gear, all under one roof. Book fishing or hunting trips with outfitters and guides, too. It's the Upper Midwest's biggest outdoor sale. Join us at the Minneapolis Convention Center, March 14th through 17th, northwestsportsshow.com.
Spring is here and your next outdoor adventure awaits. From hiking and biking, our picturesque trails, to kayaking or fishing our lake and waterways, Mason City and Clear Lake, Iowa offer endless opportunities for outdoor recreation. Gather your friends and family and discover the beauty of nature as you explore our stunning landscapes and immerse yourself in unforgettable experiences. Learn more at thisisnorthiowa.com.
Unleash the power of the Onyx Hunt app this turkey season and see how it'll become one of the best tools in your turkey vest. Use color-coded public and private land ownership information, tree species, and crop layers to scout from the comfort of your home. Then hit the field using compass mode, waypoints, and multiple base maps to help pin down more gobblers this spring. Use promo code ODN20 to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt.
Since 1967, generations of Minnesota sportsmen have trusted Outdoor News to keep them up to date with the latest news, pro tips, features, fishing reports, gear reviews, and more. For less than a buck per week, you can carry on the tradition and join thousands of Minnesota sportsmen by subscribing to Outdoor News. Whether you prefer a printed copy in your mailbox each week or the convenience of up-to-the-minute news on your smartphone or computer, we've got you covered. Subscribe today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Have more success on the ice with the LiveScope Plus Ice Fishing Bundle LI from Garmin. Drill fewer holes, catch more fish. This portable live sonar bundle comes with the LiveScope Plus system, EchoMap UHD 93 SV display, and a lithium battery. All packaged in a case, making hole hopping a breeze. LiveScope Plus helps you find more fish with improved resolution, reduced noise, clearer images, and better target separation. Fill your freezer with fillets with help from Garmin. Visit Garmin.com or shop your local Garmin dealer today.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
Horses, what you desire, don't play with matches, don't play with fire.
After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. And remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Everybody, welcome back to the broadcast. I am Rob Jerisline. You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. I hope you like what we chat about here. If you do, check us out online at outdoornews.com, or you can give us a call at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to print or digital versions, either via that phone number or that website. Hey, I want to check in now with a friend of mine I've known many years here in the conservation community in Minnesota. He recently received a very well-deserved award, and I want to talk to him a little bit about that award and also about what he's got cooking as the manager of conservation programs for Ducks Unlimited in Minnesota. His name is John Schneider, and he joins us now. John, hi. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Rob. Thanks for the opportunity.
Tori McCormick wrote a really nice story about you for Outdoor News a couple weeks ago, noting that you just received a Lifetime Achievement Award from Ducks Unlimited. You've been with the organization since late 90s, is that about right?
1997, actually. Okay. December 1997.
Yeah, and you've been in Minnesota that whole time, or did you work for DU outside of Minnesota for a bit too?
Yeah, I actually joined Ducks Unlimited in 97 in Arkansas. I was stationed with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission in Stuttgart, Arkansas, the duck capital of the world.
You bet, yeah.
Worked for the commission for just over 4 years before Ducks Unlimited hired me away, and I opened our first office in Arkansas and Stuttgart there to launch our conservation program there before moving up to Minnesota.
They love their duck hunting down in Arkansas. You got your start out in New York State, though, huh? That's where you started. You did a fair amount of diver hunting out there. Is that right? Was that on the Great Lakes?
Yeah, I grew up in Western New York in Orchard Park, where the Buffalo Bills play, actually. So I commiserate with all the Vikings bear at not making better time of our opportunities at the Super Bowl. But yeah, I grew up waterfowl hunting in Long Point, Ontario, with my father on the north shore of Lake Erie. Undergraduate school at SUNY Oswego, north of Syracuse, and then went and did a graduate program down at Texas A&M in Kingsville, Texas.
So since coming to Minnesota, you've grown the DU office to, originally started out, it was just you and another person, right? It's up to 20 people now. Is that out? Where is that office? Is that out in Alex or Fergus Falls?
Yeah, actually, I work out of my home in Alexandria. We do have an office with engineering staff in Garfield, Minnesota, just west of Alexandria. So we've grown since 1999. I moved north from Arkansas, and Ducks Unlimited hired Tom Landwehr away from the Minnesota DNR. And it was the two of us for many years. We added a field biologist and an engineer along the way. So we were at about four staff prior to the passage of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment that dedicated conservation funding that the Minnesota voters passed in 2008 has really allowed us to expand and grow our conservation program in the state.
Well, I was going to talk about that a little bit more later, but I think we should hone in on it now since you brought it up. Yeah, that passed in 08, and we worked on it the better part of a decade. You worked on it too to help get that passed that election night 2008. It was a big deal. A lot of money devoted to on-the-ground habitat projects, and it really, I wouldn't say revitalized, you guys were doing work before, but I mean, the volume of work you've been able to do to restore wetlands, expand WMAs, improve WMAs and WPAs, it's just flabbergasting what you've been able to accomplish since voters decided to dedicate that sales tax.
Absolutely. It's been a game changer and a blessing. And I, as a resident of Minnesota now, I take it pretty seriously. We're spending taxpayer dollars to do really good work for wildlife habitat. That's our expertise, with a focus on wetlands and prairies. We're focused in the prairie pothole region of southwest Minnesota, central and southwest and western Minnesota. You know, in the prairie pothole region, Rob, we've lost 90% of our prairie wetlands, and 99% of the native grasslands have been plowed under. So we're very much in a restoration mode here. Fortunately, in the Dakotas and Montana, we still have enough native prairie that that's remained right side up, that our focus there is in protecting prairies and wetlands that haven't been drained. Here, it's very much of a restoration mode we're in.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio, Rob Gerisline chatting with John Schneider. He's the manager of conservation programs for Ducks Unlimited Minnesota, and his employer just saw fit to give him a Lifetime Achievement Award, a very well-deserved Lifetime Achievement Award. One last point on the dedicated funding. It passed in 08. That's not permanent. That was for 25 years dedicated funding, which means we're less than 10 years away from having to restore that. And I know there's groups already starting to think about that. That's something we'll be talking about a lot. John, all this work you're doing, it's ultimately about what? Putting ducks on the landscape, right? That's what you're trying to do. You think you're delivering those results too?
We think we are. I mean, habitat, especially breeding habitat, is scientifically even shown to be the limiting factor for duck populations. It's a little different for geese and other birds. But for ducks, what happens in the spring and summer drives their population status. And most of that's driven by weather. Wet years, we have lots of ducks. Drought years, we don't. But man-made drainage and other impacts has really affected breeding duck populations as well. So we're doing what we can to address that here in Minnesota. The outdoor heritage funds cannot be spent out of state. They have to be spent here. We're focused both on breeding habitat as well as brood rearing habitat, larger wetlands, larger marshes. The other thing we're doing is working on migration habitat as well. And that's our Living Lakes Initiative was launched in 2004 before dedicated funding. And at that time, we had very limited money and we were focused on, you know, what we could bring to the table, which was our engineering expertise to help the Minnesota DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service improve brood rearing and migration marshes, the bigger wetlands and shallow lakes that were full of carp and devoid of vegetation and aquatic invertebrates. So we continue doing that work, but the legacy amendment has allowed us to expand into breeding work, which is, you know, again, expensive when you have to buy easements or land. We think we're making a difference. It's tricky in Minnesota because many of the ducks that hunters see in the fall come from outside the state, at least 50% in most years. We're focused on putting more wetlands and grass on the landscape and improving our marshes and shallow lakes here for birds that migrate through in the spring, too, on their way north to breed. That was shown to be at least somewhat of a constraint for some species. Bluebills, for example, weren't getting the nutrition they historically had as they migrated north through the state. So that was one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we began to focus on shallow lakes. We're making a difference, but you know, it's been over 100 years of drainage and conversion that we've lost our prairie potholes and grasslands in southwest Minnesota. So it's going to take time for us to put that back. And
I think, John, I think they call that job security, don't they?
Well, yeah, it's going to take more than job for me. It's going to take the next generation too to continue working on it and people that follow us. And to your point earlier, hopefully we can have the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment reauthorized in 2034 by showing some of the gains we've made.
John, I'll tell you, we're about out of time, but I want to ask you one quick question, which is, I got to think your work's pretty gratifying. I mean, when you see a piece of ground that you know used to be contain wetlands and all sorts of upland grassland, and it's been tiled and it's an ag field, and you folks are able to go in and bust up those tile lines, and then 2 or 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden it looks like this wildlife cornucopia again. Or maybe it's an existing WPA where you go in and you see a basin that's full of carp, and you got to go in there and you got to devote some dollars to eliminating those carp. And a couple years later, it's full of wild celery or sago pond weed. That's got to be pretty satisfying to see that work on the ground pay dividends and results within a few years.
Absolutely. And we hear that from our members and supporters too. We can't do our work without strong private member support. DU's got about 50,000 members here in the state. And every year we gather at our state convention and tell them about the work we're doing. And we've received really positive feedback. But you're right, it is gratifying, especially size matters. And, you know, we've purchased one square section of land in Nobles County, 644 acres. We just closed on a 538-acre parcel in Murray and Lyon County, south of Marshall recently, bringing those big blocks of land back into small wetland habitat and grassland habitats. Extremely rewarding, and I think the public appreciates it.
Well, thanks for all you do as a longtime waterfowler. You know, we had a pretty good duck hunt here this past year. That had to be gratifying too, right? Getting out and shooting some birds here in Minnesota.
Traditions continue, and that's part of the mix too. Without hunting traditions, the support for conservation will wane. So we're thrilled that people still partake in the sport.
Well, if folks want to see what you got cooking, they can go to ducks.org/Minnesota. Lots of good information there on some of the projects you're working on. And of course, I'd encourage folks to read Tori McCormick's story about you at OutdoorNews.com. Congrats on the award, John. Very well deserved. And I'm looking forward to working with you for decades to come.
Sounds great. Thanks, Rob.
All right, that's our friend John Schneider. Congratulations to him. John is the manager of conservation programs for Ducks Unlimited Minnesota, and that organization just gave him a big Conservation Lifetime Achievement Award. More information at ducks.org. Let's break more of the broadcast after these messages.
Fort Dodge, Iowa, outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
The biggest public lands bash is headed to the heartland. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Rendezvous is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center April 18th through the 20th, and you don't want to miss it. Experience three action-packed days with top names in the outdoors, seminars, exhibitors, wild game cook-offs, calling competitions, a kids area, and more. Win big with prizes, auctions, and raffles all weekend. Full event and day passes are available at backcountryhunters.org under the Rendezvous tab. See you there.
Spring is here and your next outdoor adventure awaits. From hiking and biking, our picturesque trails, to kayaking or fishing our lake and waterways, Mason City and Clear Lake, Iowa offer endless opportunities for outdoor recreation. Gather your friends and family and discover the beauty of nature as you explore our stunning landscapes and immerse yourself in unforgettable experiences. Learn more at thisisnorthiowa.com.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today.
Jason's Guide Service is your top option for Alaska's Kenai River salmon and trout fishing. If an Alaskan adventure is in your future, the Kenai River is essential to your experience, and to get the best river adventure, make it a day on the water with one of the experienced guides from Jason's Guide Service. Jason is already taking reservations for the summer of 2024, so visit jasonsguideservice.com for more information. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Hey, Steve Panaz here. For too long, Minnesota anglers have not had a strong voice at the legislature or the DNR. You can help ensure the quality of state fisheries by joining the MinFish Sport Fishing Foundation. Individual memberships are free and life memberships are available. MinFish Foundation is dedicated to restoring, protecting, and enhancing Minnesota's sport fishing opportunities. To join us, visit min-fish.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Outdoor News Radio. Rob Driesline with you for another segment. Appreciate you joining the broadcast. If you like what we chat about here, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. We have print or digital subscriptions to the content we produce every week that we produce every day. Our website gets updated every day, folks, just like any other sort of daily newspaper. So check that out, OutdoorNews.com. With that, Stan Tequila back with us. Stan, good to see you. We talked last week about this migration that's unfolding so quickly here across the region. But I wanted to just swing back to earlier this winter. You traveled quite a bit, didn't you, down to Florida? And then you always make trips to Yellowstone, don't you?
Yeah, did a trip to Yellowstone this year, and yeah, it's kind of like two opposite ends of the spectrum there. Wintertime in Yellowstone is one of my favorite things. I lead photo tours there. This year we had an amazing encounter with the Wapiti pack, which is a fairly dominant pack within the Yellowstone ecosystem.
Of wolves.
Yeah. And they had discovered a very large bull bison. I mean, this guy is really big, maybe close to 2,000 pounds. And he was kind of on the older side and had some injuries and, you know, it wasn't doing very well. And for about a day and a half, these wolves kind of just harassed this bison, trying to kill a 2,000-pound bison with your teeth, which is literally what these guys do. I mean, because we oftentimes think, oh, well, that's easy for them to kill. Well, think about what wolves do to kill. They have to literally bite it to death.
Well, getting the snot kicked out of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Stan, so, if I can jump in with one quick point, I have both talked about this in the past, but I think it's worth bringing up. When I've been to Yellowstone and I've watched wolves around bison, you know, through telescopes, through optics, it is so striking how small they look compared to the buffalo. I mean, they look like puppies, you know, running around. That's how big these bison are.
Yeah, average weight of the wolves in Yellowstone is about 70 to 80 pounds. And these bison are running, big males are running 2,000 pounds, females are running 1,000 pounds. These are very large animals. And then this is why wolves hunt in packs, because a single wolf can't do anything about this. So anyhow, so they waited around for this bison, who then was seeking refuge in the Firehole River. Firehole River is a very well-known river, shallow, fast-moving, and after about a day or so, the bison literally just kind of gave up and drowned, which gave the wolves its opportunity, and then they were just, you know, sprung into action. Within 12 hours, maybe 15 hours, that carcass was down to rib cages and a spinal column, and the head was still there because there's not much to eat, and then the fur. You know, like a large, you know, bison robe basically was left over. And that always amazes me how efficient the ecosystem is. So ravens are there, bobcats are there, coyotes, foxes, wolves, everything's coming in and everybody's taking a little piece. And it, you know, within 24 hours, you know, it was to the point where nobody was even showing up anymore for the carcass because it was pretty well cleaned off. And I always find that absolutely amazing. And within, you know, 2 days of it dying, there's virtually nothing left of this carcass. And that always, every time I see it, I'm always like, the efficiency in nature is unparalleled. It's amazing.
Didn't your column say that the carcass, did it float downstream a little bit, or did the wolves kind of help drag it downstream to like a sandbar or something?
Yeah, it floated just a little bit down about 100 yards and then got stuck on a little sandbar. The river is only about anywhere from 12 to 18 inches deep, though, so it's not like it's a raging deep river. And that's where most of the feeding took place, was on or in the water. So I have a whole series of images of the wolves, you know, walking through the water out to the carcass and then feeding on it there, then coming back. Coyotes would do the same thing. And it was amazing to watch, because the wolves were on there, and then the wolves would kind of walk away and go up into the woods and lay down for a while. And there was one wolf who was there on its own, and it was a younger wolf. By the way, you can see the difference between the older and younger wolves by the guard hairs on their coat. And, you know, so this one was pretty obviously a young 1-year-old wolf. And as it would leave the carcass, I mean, it didn't get 10 steps away from the carcass when a raven would fly in and land on it. And this really upset that wolf. And so he would turn and run back and chase off that raven. And then he'd start walking away again. And then two ravens would fly in. And then he'd get upset and turn around and run back. And he was just like, you know, get away type of thing. And after this went on for about maybe 10 or 15 times, if the wolf finally just gave up and walked off. And within 10 seconds after the wolf walked off, there's, you know, 15 ravens on the carcass, tearing it apart, you know, just working at every little bit of it off. So it was really amazing to watch.
Stan, a lot to unpack there. Guard hairs. I don't think I know a whole lot about that. What are guard hairs, and how do you use those to detect the difference between adults and younger, more juvenile wolves?
Oh, great question. So when you the fur on any of these animals has different components to it. So it has an underfur, which is usually a softer, shorter, type fur, which is meant really for warmth. Then you have the outer guard hairs. These are the longer hairs, which give the animal its color and also gives it its kind of, you know, shape, if you will. And the guard hairs in these younger wolves is much longer, like in the range of 2 to 3 inches longer. So it's really, they look really fluffy, if you will. The adults have this really compact looking coat of fur. And when you look at the young ones, which are about a year old, it's much more, it's like they have a bad hair day. You know, it's more fuzzy and frizzy and sticks out like that. So you can really see the difference between them. I can text you over a couple of pictures. You can see the examples of these. And
it might be a good column topic, Stan.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's funny, oftentimes when photographing these animals, because there's a lot of action happening all at once, you don't notice those things.
Mm-hmm.
But later, when you have the images up on the computer and you're going through them one by one, it's like this stuff stands out to me so obvious. I'm like, oh, wow, look at that. You know, because you're trying to get your exposures correct. You're trying to get your composition correct. You're trying to get, you know, catch the action. And so you're concentrating on that. But then when you've got the images on the computer, you can really study it and look at it and go, okay.
Zoom in, yep. You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Jerisline and Stan Tequila talking a little bit about his recent winter trip to Yellowstone National Park. I'd like to wrap up the segment talking a little bit about buffalo, Stan. I think sometimes I maybe am a little guilty of taking buffalo for granted. And I think Americans maybe are too. They're truly an amazing species that we almost lost. We lost the passenger pigeon. We've lost other species. And we almost lost this incredibly iconic American species, the buffalo, the American bison. And now we've got a lot, thanks to conservation efforts. There's even some talk, there's some rumblings of trying to expand and reintroduce buffalo into more of its native range. I know Lan Tawney, formerly at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, that's a personal issue for him. It might be easier said than done. But, you know, this is a species that's been in North America, right, I don't know, since the Pleistocene or something, right? It almost, when you see these animals, they're so huge. They're almost like this remnant from the Ice Age, from a different era. And I'm so glad that we still have them.
Yeah, I would agree with you, too. And we oftentimes misunderstand them. It's the number one animal that causes injuries in our national parks.
Yeah.
So, you know, we think, oh, it's like a cow or something like that.
Right. And
these are very large animals who don't take kindly to people coming up to them.
Right.
And they'll defend themselves.
They're not fluffy cows.
No, they are not. And you're absolutely right. We almost did lose them at one point. They were almost all killed off. There was actual bison sanctuaries where they were afraid they were going to lose them all, so they started putting them in different sanctuaries around the country to be able to preserve the genetics of it. Now they're looking at it saying that a lot of the bison in the eastern half of the United States have a significant amount of cow DNA in them, in the bovine DNA in them. The ones in Yellowstone apparently are the one true set of bison who are genetically pure.
We've got a few herds here in Minnesota too that I believe are pretty darn pure. I believe, you know, the DNR and some other agents, the Minnesota Zoo, have done a good job of preserving those genes with these herds too. So that's good news.
It's an interesting thing too that things that happened in our past are showing up now. And one good example of that is, you know, I'm sorry to go back to the wolves at Yellowstone, but last I checked, I think it was like 60% of them are black. Only about 3% of the wolves in Minnesota are black. They're gray. There's a reason why the official name is Eastern Gray Wolf, you know, or just Gray Wolf. That's because they're normally gray. The reason why there are so many black wolves is because there is dog DNA genetics that were introduced about 200 years ago that into the wolf population that gave them that black, that melanistic look. And I find that fascinating because now it's made its way in. And the latest research I was just reading about is that this gene that has turned majority of the wolves in Yellowstone to be melanistic, to be in a black color, is also helping them against mange, which I find hard to even wrap my brain around. Mange is a mite that gets under their skin, and apparently it's something that helps them with a defense against that. So I just find that really amazing that something so long ago would be still present today.
Well, we're running out of time here, Stan, but those wolves were reintroduced. That was a reintroduction effort out there in Yellowstone. Yes. Yes. Where did they get those wolves from that they've got all this, that they've apparently got some dog DNA that's responsible for that black color? That's odd to me.
Yeah, Canada is where most of them came from. You can see this happening in the same way that when you get wolf and coyote hybrids.
Sure.
You can see that, it comes mating time. You've got a wolf who's looking for a mate and looking for reproduction. And it's like, well, they don't see any wolves around. And it's like, hey, you, coyote, come here. You know,
right.
That. And the same thing with the dog, too. I don't understand the genetics that well. I'm not a geneticist at all. But they in these studies, they say that they can look back and pinpoint the time in which this comes into play. And that stuff is a little bit beyond my pale. I can't figure that stuff out, but I find it fascinating.
Well, one final thought. You said the bison is probably responsible for more attacks on humans than any other animal. I got to think the moose might be a close second or a second place. A lot of people get beat up by moose, too, because they think they can go pet the deer, the big deer.
Yeah, the main difference there is that the bison just stand there, and you can walk right up to them. The moose, they'll run away, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, the bears are a real problem. Bears are big for backcountry hiking and things like that. And the big problem there is when you scare one, when you
Surprise one.
You surprise one. There, thank you. Where you surprise when you walk up on it, and their natural reaction is to neutralize whatever it is that just scared them.
Mm-hmm.
And, and unfortunately, the outcome is never very good.
Big teeth, big claws. Stan, thanks for coming in. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, Rob. Talk to you next time.
That's our friend Stan Tequila. Let's break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Fort Dodge, Iowa, outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
Don't miss the Discover Boating Northwest Sports Show in partnership with Progressive Insurance. March 14th through 17th at the Minneapolis Convention Center. It's your last chance to gear up before the boating and fishing season openers. Find once-a-year show deals on hundreds of new boats, plus fishing tackle, docks and lifts, marine electronics, ATVs, hunting and outdoor gear, all under one roof. Book fishing or hunting trips with outfitters and guides, too. It's the Upper Midwest's biggest outdoor sale. Join us at the Minneapolis Convention Center, March 14th through 17th, northwestsportsshow.com.
Spring is here and your next outdoor adventure awaits. From hiking and biking, our picturesque trails, to kayaking or fishing our lake and waterways, Mason City and Clear Lake, Iowa offer endless opportunities for outdoor recreation. Gather your friends and family and discover the beauty of nature as you explore our stunning landscapes and immerse yourself in unforgettable experiences. Learn more at thisisnorthiowa.com.
Since 1967, Outdoor News has been Minnesota's go-to news source for all things out of doors. Generations of hunters and anglers have welcomed Outdoor News into their home each week, enjoying the most up-to-date news, features, columnists, fishing and hunting reports, gear reviews, and much, much more. For less than a dollar a week, you can join thousands of other Minnesota sportsmen and continue the long-standing tradition of subscribing to Outdoor News. Both print and digital versions are available. Start your subscription today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
The biggest public lands bash is headed to the heartland. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers North American Rendezvous is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center April 18th through the 20th, and you don't want to miss it. Experience three action-packed days with top names in the outdoors, seminars, exhibitors, wild game cook-offs, calling competitions, a kids area, and more. Win big with prizes, auctions, and raffles all weekend. Full event and day passes are available at backcountryhunters.org under the Rendezvous tab. See you there.
Every year, countless birds and small mammals are killed by domestic cats. Every year, the lives of these same free-roaming cats are cut short when they're run over by cars, attacked by other animals, contract diseases, parasites, or poisoned. The Minnesota Cats Indoors Project is encouraging people to keep their cat indoors, not only for the cat's safety, but for the sake of birds and wildlife as well. For more information, visit American Bird Conservancy's website at www.abcbirds.org.
Welcome back, everybody. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. Rob Driesline, happy to be with you. Thank you, Stan Tequila, who just joined us for the second week in a row. We also had John Schneider with us from Ducks Unlimited. Fun catching up with John a little bit. I think we're going to get my dad with us next week, talk a little bit about this solar eclipse coming in April. My dad's all excited about it. It's on Monday, April 8th. So mark your calendar, and like I say, we'll talk about that more next week. If you like the broadcast, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. And with that, yeah, let's introduce Tim Lesmeister. Tim, you're going to help me bring it home. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm actually looking forward to that solar eclipse, too. Yeah. Don't look straight at that. You have to use devices.
Yep. No, we'll be very clear. You got to have the right safety goggles on or whatever. Tim, I got a fun little item for you I wanted to ask you about. My wife and son, middle boy, for his spring break, went to the UK. They went to London last week, and they had a good time, checked out a lot of the sites, did some day trips out of London, really had a nice trip. The last day, they were in the town of Salisbury. They were checking out Stonehenge, went into Salisbury, had lunch. They were in a pub, and everybody over there runs around with their dogs, right? You probably know that from your time in the UK. And a guy walked up with like a whippet hound or something like that. It was a beautiful dog, friendly dog. And my wife, you know, Annette, she can be pretty loud, probably overwhelms those Europeans a bit. But she's like, "What kind of dog is this? Oh, what a beautiful dog. It's great." And the guy went out of his way. He said, "Well, it's not a dog. It's a hound. Please be clear. It's a hound, not a dog." And they're like, "Okay." And then they interacted with him some more. And as they were leaving, the guy, Annette, said, "Oh, I just love your dog." And the guy almost got kind of crabby. He's like, "I told you it's a hound." Well, we had some chuckles over that. And I did a little bit of, you know, just Googling of the two terms. Not all dogs are hounds, but by every definition I can find, Tim, all hounds are dogs. Now, you spent some time in the UK. Do they get worked up about those terms?
Well, they get worked up about their dogs like crazy. I lived over there for a year in 97, 98, and there's big signs on the doors of the pubs that say, "No children allowed. Dogs are welcome." They love their dogs over there. They hate kids. And so it's kind of interesting how that works. So, yes, they do get really worked up about their dogs. And you have to be very careful over there that you don't, like, give one of their dogs, like, a piece of bacon or some meat off your plate or something like that. They'll go crazy on you. You know, they get really crazy over there about their dogs.
Have you ever bumped into that before, the difference between trying to define the difference between hound and dog and making a big deal out of it? I mean, yeah, if it's a specific breed, a whippet hound, sure, I'll refer to my dog by, it's this type of hound. But if someone calls it a dog, I'm not going to be offended by that.
Oh, no, I was over in Ireland, and they love to use greyhounds over there to chase rabbits. Now, they can't do that anymore. They call it coursing. But what they do is they use dummy rabbits now, and it's fun to watch. But they're greyhounds, and you don't call them dogs. You call them hounds. You don't say, "Hey, you got some great dogs," because if you do, then they'll kick you out of the park and tell you that you need to go somewhere where you can learn what the difference is between a hound and a dog. But you're right. I think that they are, in fact, just dogs.
If someone called me out on that, I would call them back and say, "All hounds are dogs. Calm down." I generally am pretty open-minded and respectful of terminology, but that's totally ridiculous. Everything I've encountered since researching that, it strikes me as totally ridiculous. And maybe there's someone out there listening who gets worked up about it. Don't call my setter a dog or, you know, whatever. Go ahead and email me, editor@outdoornews.com, if you want to explain what I'm missing.
You know what I get a kick out of? I'm down here in Florida all winter long, and there'll be 8 baby carriages go by me when I'm sitting at a outdoor spot having some lunch or drinking a beverage, and there'll be 8 or 9 or 10 carriages go by me, baby carriages, baby strollers, and 9 of the 10 will have dogs in them. Only one will have a baby.
Yeah, we wonder why there's a demographic crunch going on in the Western world, right? When people aren't having kids, they're just taking care of dogs. Dogs will never pay taxes.
That is so true.
Anyway, I'm glad people like dogs. I'm a dog guy myself. Nonetheless, you're listening to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Jerisline and Tim Lesmeister wrapping up this week's show. Another story last week, this armorer in the Rust movie trial got convicted, I believe. I don't know that she's been sentenced yet. I think she faces up to 18 months. I'm guessing she won't get that much time. I could be wrong. You and I have talked about this a little bit. I think we both agree that the armorer was probably responsible. We've debated. Now, I believe also Alec Baldwin has been charged in this case. Involuntary manslaughter, I think, is the charge. And you and I have debated that a little bit. I think as an actor, from the actor's standpoint, I don't think he should be held responsible. The actors trust the armor. That's how Hollywood has worked forever. But as executive producer, if he skimped on hiring practices or something like that, it seems to me that he could be potentially liable. You don't necessarily agree, huh?
Well, I don't agree that he should be liable from a criminal standpoint. He did pull the trigger, but he was handed a gun that was basically a prop. He was told by someone that was responsible for putting blank cartridges into that gun that they were, in fact, non-lethal.
Right.
And then he pointed that gun. He pulled the trigger. It was supposed to make a noise.
He does maintain he didn't pull the trigger, but go ahead.
Somebody had to pull that trigger, and it seems to me that he was holding the gun.
Right,
so,
right.
He may not have consciously pulled the trigger, but subconsciously he pulled that trigger. Gun went off. Someone died. But yet, this was a movie. This was supposed to be a prop. This was a situation where I think if, as a producer, he could probably be civilly responsible for some monetary damages. But I think that the only people that should be responsible from a criminal standpoint would be the individual that was supposed to load that gun with a blank cartridge and did not.
Yeah, and that's the person presumably responsible for making sure there's no live rounds on the set. I mean, there should never be any live rounds, live ammunition on a movie set.
But I wonder if they're even going to come out with that film.
I guess I would be surprised if it comes out. Now, I presume there's a lot of money into that movie already. And so there's, you know, the studio doesn't want to take a major loss on it not coming out. Tim, one final thought on this armor thing. What credentials does someone need to be an armorer on a movie set? I'm curious about that. I don't necessarily expect you to know that, but you know, I wonder, did some of these armors, have they ever even taken a firearm safety class? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm guessing that it's probably a friend of a friend of a friend who talks to one of the producers, probably not even one of the executive producers, and said, I got a friend whose dad had a gun and they got to hold it one time, so let's put them to work here because they're really cool and we can have some fun on the set.
I presume there's armorers out in Hollywood. There are people with these skill sets, and they know people, and they apprentice, you know, maybe some of these folks. But I'd be curious if there's any sort of credential system that goes into being an armorer on a Hollywood movie set.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting question. I agree with you.
Tim, final quick thought. We don't even have time to talk about it. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling in the Mille Lacs case. It was 5-4 ruling that finally decided the bands indeed pretty much had the right to co-management of the within the 1837 treaty area. Hard to believe it's been a quarter of a century, huh?
It is really hard to believe that it's been that long, and what has literally come about because of that and how it has evolved.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Tim, thanks for spending a segment with me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. We'll catch up to you soon.
That's our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, John Schneider, Stan Tequila, and Tim Spielman. Everybody, have a great week out of doors. Rob Jerisline signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.